We're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, and we will read the verse, we'll chant a verse from chapter 6, but before that, I'll read the final verse of chapter 5, entitled Durvasa Muni's Life Spared. Verse 28. By the grace of the Lord, those who hear about the activities of Maharaj Ambarisha, the great devotee, certainly become liberated or become devotees without delay. I'll just mention, it's interesting, the verse says, Muktim Prayanti, they go to liberation. And Prabhupada adds in his translation, they go to liberation, they become liberated, or become devotees. No doubt this comes from commentaries, whether Sridhar Swami or Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur or more commentators. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purports of the ninth canto, fifth chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Durvasa Muni's Life Spared. A very nice two chapters, chapter 4 and 5, some of the most important of the ninth canto, telling us actually an interesting kind of reversal. Much of the Bhagavatam tells us, be careful, don't offend brahmanas. Of course, much of the Bhagavatam says don't offend Vaishnavas, but in terms of varna, dharma, it's usually the brahmanas that are praised, and one is warned not to offend. But of course, in this case, we have a kshatriya, Ambarisha, and he's the one who prevails, you could say, is shown to be the one not to be offended. Durvasa is the brahmana who, thinking, I am a brahmana, gets in big trouble. But his life is spared. Why? Why is his life spared? Sorry? Why was Durvasa spared? Yes, because the title of this chapter is Durvasa Muni's Life Spared. So, yes, because Durvasa submitted himself, he surrendered, he apologized. Apology is a good thing. Okay, chapter 6, the downfall of Sobari Muni. The story of Sobari comes toward the end of this chapter. Shall we read the summary? Summary? Summaries. We read summaries at Bhaktivedanta Manor. Okay. Here we go. Get ready for lots of names. And if you fall asleep, I'll understand. After describing the descendants of Maharaj Ambarisha, Sugadeva Goswami described all the kings from Sashada to Mandata. And in this connection, he also described how the great sage Sobari married the daughters of Mandata. Maharaj Ambarish had three sons named Virupa, Ketuman, and Shambhu. The son of Virupa was Prishadashva, and his son was Ratitara. Ratitara had no sons. But when he requested that the favor of the great sage Angira, the sage begot several sons in the womb of Ratitara's wife. When the sons were born, they became the dynasty of Angira Rishi and of Ratitara. The son of Manu was Ikshvaku, who had 100 sons, of whom Vikukshi, Nimi, and Dandaka were the eldest. The sons of Maharaj Ikshvaku became kings of different parts of the world. Because of violating sacrificial rules and regulations, one of these sons, Vikukshi, was banished from the kingdom. By the mercy of Vasishta and the power of mystic yoga, Maharaj Ikshvaku attained liberation after giving up his material body. When Maharaj Ikshvaku expired, his son Vikukshi returned and took charge of the kingdom. He performed various types of sacrifices, and thus he pleased the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This Vikukshi later became celebrated as Shashada. Vikukshi's son fought with the demons for the sake of the demigods, and because of his valuable service, he became famous as Puranjaya, Indravaha, and Kakutsta. The son of Puranjaya was Anina. The son of Anina was Prithu, and the son of Prithu was Vishvagandhi. The son of Vishvagandhi was Chandra, the son of Chandra was Yuvanashva, and his son was Shravasta, who constructed Shravastipuri. The son of Shravasta was Brihadashva. Brihadashva's son, Kuvalayashva, killed a demon named Dundu, and thus he became celebrated as Dundumara, the killer of Dundu. The sons of the killer of Dundu were Dridashva, Kapilashva, and Badrashva. He also had thousands of other sons, but they burned to ashes in the fire emanating from Dundu. The son of Drid... We're only halfway through this. The son of Dridashva was Haryashva. The son of Haryashva was Nikumbha. The son of Nikumbha... You're going to be tested on all this. The son of Nikumbha was Bahulashva, and the son of Bahulashva was Krishashva. The son of Krishashva was Senajit, and his son was... He knows. That's amazing. Yuvanashva. Oh, that's cheating. You almost fooled me there for a minute. You know, like, well, of course, it was Yuvanashva. Okay, Yuvanashva married 100 wives, but he had no sons, and therefore he entered the forest. In the forest, the sages performed a sacrifice known as Indra Yajna on his behalf. Once, however, the king became so thirsty in the forest that he drank the water kept for performing yajna. Consequently, after some time, a son came forth from the right side of his abdomen. The son, who was very beautiful, was crying to drink breast milk, and Indra gave the child his index finger to suck. Thus the son became known as Mandhata. So, now you know why he was known as Mandhata. In due course of time, Yuvanashva achieved perfection by performing austerities. Thereafter, Mandhata became the emperor and ruled the earth, which consisted of 7 islands. Thieves and rogues were very much afraid of this powerful king, and therefore the king was known as Trasadasyu, meaning one who is very fearful to rogues and thieves. Mandhata begot sons in the womb of his wife, Bindumati. These sons were Purukuksa, Ambarisha, and Muchukunda. These 3 sons had 50 sisters, all of whom became wives of the great sage known as Sobari. In this connection, Shukadeva Goswami described the history of Sobari Muni, who, because of sensual agitation caused by fish, fell from his yoga and wanted to marry all the daughters of Mandata for sexual pleasure. Later, Sovaramuni became very regretful. Thus, he accepted the order of Vanaprastha, performed very severe austerities, and thus attained perfection. In this regard, Shukadeva Goswami described how Sovaramuni's wives also became perfect. Text number 1. Shukadeva Goswami said, O Maharaj Parikshit, Ambarish had 3 sons named Virupa, Ketuman, and Shambhu. From Virupa came a son named Prishadashva, and from Prishadashva came a son named Ratitara. And now we have verse number 2, which translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Translation. Ratitara had no sons, and therefore he requested the great sage Angira to beget sons for him. Because of this request, Angira begot sons in the womb of Ratitara's wife. All these sons were born with Brahminical prowess. Please repeat, Ratitara had no sons. And therefore, he requested the great sage Angira to beget sons for him. Because of this request, Angira begot sons in the womb of Ratitara's wife. All these sons were born with Brahminical prowess. Purport. In the Vedic age, a man was sometimes called upon to beget sons in the womb of a lesser man's wife for the sake of better progeny. In such an instance, the woman is compared to an agricultural field. That's what it says here. A person possessing an agricultural field may employ another person to produce food grains from it. But because the grains are produced from the land, they are considered the property of the owner of the land. Similarly, a woman was sometimes allowed to be impregnated by someone other than her husband. But the sons born of her would then become her husband's sons. Such sons were called Kshetrajata. Because Ratitara had no sons, he took advantage of this method. Well, there you go. It's in the Bhagavatam. What's that? You could get arrested for that nowadays, Mar says. Ratitarasya prajasya bharyayam tantavertida angira janayamasa brahma varchasvina sutan. Ratitara had no sons, and therefore he requested the great sage Angira to beget sons for him. Because of this request, Angira begot sons in the womb of Ratitara's wife. All these sons were born with Brahminical prowess. Before we get into the immediate subject here, I thought let's talk a little about the broader picture. We read the overview of this chapter, lots of names of kings. And indeed, this is only a small portion of the names of kings that we get in the Srimad Bhagavatam. What we're hearing about are the succession. We're getting family history. We're getting dynastic history. And the sort of end, the sum of all the names that we get from this family history. I don't know what the sum is, but it must be several hundred. You could say adds up to what Sri Dayananda Maharaj calls a cosmic village. it's actually, relatively speaking, a small number. But it's understood that from all of these kings, of course, then there is so much, so many descendants. And directly or indirectly, the implication is that everyone on the planet are descended from these kings. Now, there's a lot of concern, it seems. One may ask, why do we have to hear all these names? What's so important? Who cares about, you know, all these names that we never heard of? Well, one thing is that persons from earlier ages might well have been familiar with many of these names. They may have, in fact, been able to say, oh yes, I come from King Krishashva, or indeed from Mandata, or whoever. So they may have, in earlier times, been able to connect themselves, or we could assume that would have been the case. Nowadays, we may be more disconnected, but the Bhagavatam, by giving these names, is giving us a sense of connection, even if it's not specific. Even if we don't know a precise connection, we have some sense of connection being there. On the other side, something else is happening in the Bhagavatam, and that is a concern about continuity of succession. Two types of succession. One is biological and the other is spiritual. And so we hear not once but several times in the Bhagavatam about the siblic succession. And woven together with this, and this happens also in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, in Adi Lila, in chapters 9, 10, 11, 12, we get this description of the Chaitanya tree with all details. So many names are there, and they're all belonging to different branches and sub-branches. And if you read that carefully, you'll see that it's a combination of two kinds of family. They're kind of interwoven in Krishnadas Kaviraj's description. The two kinds of families are biological families and spiritual families. Sometimes he's listing names of sons of such and such, and sometimes he's referring to disciples. And of course, sometimes they're both. They're disciples and sons. So this sense, this concern about continuity is very much there in the Bhagavatam. And when it's not there, it's a big problem. That story we get especially in the Mahabharata. The story about what happens when there's a problem of continuity of sons from parents. So, we have the case of Vichitravirya. Isn't that Vichitravirya could not have sons, and therefore, who was called in? Vyasadeva. And what happens when Vyasadeva beget sons by the wives of Vichitravirya? All kinds of trouble. And then we have the case of Pandu not being able to produce sons because of a curse. And so there's a substitution done, in this case, with demigods. And we know how much trouble that becomes, in effect. Especially with regard to Karna, the first son of Kunti, by Surya. Of course, that all happened before the problem with Pandu. But these accounts are about the problem of continuity of succession. And of course, the war of the Mahabharata Wars is the contest over who is going to continue this line, essentially. So this is a big worry. And it's a big worry, especially among kings. And this is interesting in the Bhagavatam because what is the lesson to kings that we get in Canto 12? We get a lesson, a very nice lesson, from Bhumi, the Bhumi Gita. Basically, she laughs at all of this. So I thought I'll read some of these verses. This is Canto 12, Chapter 3, starting with verse 3. She says, this is Bhumi Devi, the earth. She says, kings and politicians imagine, and then she's quoting what kings imagine, first I will conquer my senses and mind. Let me back up to verse 2. Great rulers of men, even those who are learned, meet frustration and failure because of material lust. Driven by lust, these kings place great hope and faith in the dead lump of flesh called the body, even though the material frame is as fleeting as bubbles of foam on water. Kings and politicians imagine, first I will conquer my senses and mind, then I will subdue my chief ministers and rid myself of the thorn pricks of my advisors, citizens, friends, and relatives, as well as the keepers of my elephants. Apparently, keepers of elephants could be dangerous characters because they could send their elephant to trample their kings if they didn't like them. In this way, I will gradually conquer the entire earth. Because the hearts of these leaders are bound by great expectations, they fail to see death waiting nearby. After conquering all the land on my surface, these proud kings, this is Bhumi speaking, forcibly enter the ocean to conquer the sea itself. What is the use of their self-control, which is aimed at political exploitation? The actual goal of self-control is spiritual liberation. O best of the Kurus, the earth continued as follows, although in the past great men and their descendants have left me, departing from this world in the same helpless way they came into it, even today foolish men are trying to conquer me. And she goes on like this, and then she gives an extensive list of kings. She names several kings. And what's interesting about this list is that she includes both devotee kings and demon kings and, indeed, avatars. Prithu Maharaj is mentioned also. And she's saying, all these kings, you know, they have come and they have gone. And there's, as Srila Prabhupada said, there's only a list of names remaining. So that list of names remains to some extent in the Srimad Bhagavatam, and we would recommend to all those who would aspire to be political leaders in the world today that they read Srimad Bhagavatam to understand their actual position. All right. To this issue of what is happening with Ratitara having no sons. It's the same thing. He has the problem of no succession of sons, and so he calls in the sage Angira in order to beget sons. It occurred to me this morning that we know of Angira in another context in the Bhagavatam, also related to the birth of a son. What's the situation? Chitraketu, yes. Narada Muni and Angira bless Chitraketu to have a son. So it seems Angira has something. He's the one you call when there is this problem. Now, another issue with regard to succession, why is it that one wants, that one considers it very important to have sons? The reason is because it's understood in the Vedic tradition that the moment we're born, we have debts. It's like, hi, welcome to the world. You have a few debts to pay. And the debts, who are the debts to? The debts are to the ancestors, to the demigods, to the rishis. These are the main ones. And then it's said to all living entities and parents, yes, included in ancestors. So, in particular, to parents, and that is a concern here. If I don't have a son, then who is going to perform the Shraddha for me? And if I don't have a son, how am I going to pay my debt to the ancestors? So I was thinking about this issue of debt. Today, practically everyone is in debt, but the form of debt that most people in the Western world, maybe in the Eastern world as well, and the Southern world, and all over the world, is debt to banks. Isn't it? Everyone is a debtor. And there's something interesting about this, and that is when one is in debt, it is not far away from being in a condition of being a slave. Now, this is actually the situation today, despite all of the rhetoric about freedom. What is really going on is that everyone is becoming enslaved, especially by banks, but in general by the monetary system. And of course, behind that, we would say everyone is enslaved by their own senses. But the issue of slavery is there, and it's not really being widely addressed. And what I would suggest is that as devotees in the Krishna consciousness movement, that this really is a major issue that we want to have a position about. And our position is that we want everyone to be free. Maharaj is preaching in prisons, so there people are very conscious of their lack of freedom. But in fact, people all over the world are lacking freedom on various levels, and some of these levels are very brutal levels. In India, although officially, according to the Indian constitution, there can be no discrimination according to caste, according to jati, the reality is that there's not only discrimination, but there is great violence. There are actual violent wars that go on between different jatis in certain parts of India. And this came to the attention of it came very much to the attention of the Indian public in the 1890s. And they had a name for what they called a problem, the pariah problem. The word pariah, you've heard this word, it means, you know, outcast, lowest of the low. It's an English word which was derived from the word pariyar, which is one of the South Indian quote-unquote untouchable castes, what today would be called Dalit. So that pariyar became pariah. And the pariah problem became an issue in the public sphere in India throughout really up to the present time, but it became transformed in various ways. One way it's been transformed is by giving different names to people who are called outcast. Before independence, as you know, I'm sure, Mahatma Gandhi gave a different name for the outcasts. What did he call them? The Harijans. Srila Prabhupada was very critical of this. Why? Rubber stamping, yes. What is this? Just to say everyone is Harijan does not make one a jana of Hari. And so, at the same time, what else did Srila Prabhupada promote in his early Back to Godhead magazines? He wrote articles, and in these articles, he was speaking about this issue of, actually before that, in The Harmonist, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur wrote an article responding to an article by Mahatma Gandhi, Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi. Gandhi had written 10 questions in which he raises this issue of the untouchables entering into the temples. This had become something of an issue that some people were pushing. Why exclude people from temples? And so Gandhi raised this question, and Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur replied to it. And then Srila Prabhupada also elaborates on this issue in an article, or more than one article, and Srila Prabhupada makes the point, what is the purpose of temples? The purpose of temples is not simply to have darshan of the deities. The purpose of temples is for education. And so, as I know you have here in Bhaktivedanta Manor, very, very nicely developed educational programs, this is really the idea of the temple. And if we understand the temple in this way, as a center of education, systematic education, development, where instead of people going to so many other educational institutions, they can come to the temple to get the higher education by which it becomes possible to gain actual freedom, then we are fulfilling our purpose in the spreading of the Krishna consciousness movement. And I would say we are, in a very small way and perhaps not yet sufficient way, addressing the issue which persists, namely the condition of bondage which is suffered by people all over the world. Sometimes we think slavery, there's no more slavery in the world. In England, it was officially outlawed in 1833, and then it took another 10 years before it was officially outlawed in India. It's officially outlawed in India, but there are people, there are millions of people in India who are essentially living in slave conditions. And if they try to leave the situation in which they are bound, they will be hunted down and killed. This is the situation. So I think it's good that we're aware of this. Now, we all have titles to our names. Actually, a few weeks ago, I sort of lost my title of Dasa. Dasa and Dasi. What does Dasa mean, or Dasi? Servant. What else does it mean? Slave. Where is the line between servant and slave? That's something we might want to think about also. And I think in this connection, we want to be aware that service, yes, we all voluntarily agree to be slaves of the Lord. But as slaves of the Lord, this does not mean that we then take advantage of others who have volunteered to be slaves of the Lord. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, Na ham vipro na chanarapatir na pivaisho na shudro, na ham varni na chagriyatir patir no yato yatir va. Kintu prodyan nikila para, etc. Gopi bartu para kamalayor dasa dasa anudasa. He's saying, first of all, what he is not, and then he's saying what he is, and he's saying what? He's saying he's the servant of the servant of the servant, 100 times removed. And so it's something we always have to remind ourselves, I'm the servant of the servant. I'm not the master of the servant. And that means that we are always in a position not allowing ourselves to therefore be exploited. Oh, hey, you're the servant of the servant, so I'm going to keep you down. No. Rather, we are, as servant of the servant, all meant to uplift everyone who are volunteering themselves. And so what this means, volunteering ourselves to serve the Lord. So what this means is we are after relationships which are nourishing. The opposite of relationships that are nourishing are relationships that are toxic. And so the endless debt that we have to our spiritual preceptors is returned, is paid back. It's never paid back, right? We accept to never have an end to our debt. Actually, what we accept is to consolidate all of our debts, like you do sometimes with credit cards. They're advertising, you know, get this credit card and you can consolidate all your debts. And then you can have one big debt, and then we'll make all the profit from your debts instead of all these other people. So, in effect, we're saying consolidate all your debts and just have one debt and never be able to pay it back. But keep trying. Is that a good deal? Yeah, it's a good deal. But it's a good deal only to that extent that we understand our position as nourishers for others who are pursuing the same path. Ratitara is making an adjustment according to a regulation which is allowed according to Dharma Shastra. And as a result of this, his problem is solved, and his sons are, in effect, upgraded according to Varna Ashrama system, because although it's explained by Srila Prabhupada that they are the sons of Ratitara, it's also explained that they become Brahmavarchasin. They become brahminically qualified. So this is an interesting little switch that happens in this chapter. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.